vous écoutez en balado-diffusion le colloque Civic Freedom in an Age of Diversity, James Tully's Public Philosophy, présenté par le groupe de recherche sur les sociétés plurinationales. Cinquième épisode, conférence de Robin Silikates, Civic Freedom and Non-Institutionalized Political Contestation.
Good morning, thanks a lot. Special thank you to Dimitri and Jocelyn for inviting me, especially since I think I'm the person on the program who has known Jim the least time. So everyone pointed out when they met him in the 80s and 90s, etc. I only met him in 2009, I think, at the University of Frankfurt. And so I'm especially pleased that I was also invited to be part of this colloquium. Thanks to all of you for showing up so early in the morning as well. Since it is so early in the morning, I thought I'll show some pictures with my talk. Don't worry, it's not too personal. But the first one actually is. I mean, I told you that I met Jim the first time in Frankfurt. It was actually in an apple wine bar. Those of you who have been to Frankfurt know what I'm talking about and can imagine that Jim was not so happy to taste this apple wine. I think it was not really something to his taste. But we did have really good discussions that evening that I remember. And back then I just finished my PhD and then started to work on a new topic, namely civil disobedience, which many sort of senior German colleagues thought was of insufficient philosophical weight to really merit sustained attention. And I remember that the conversation with Jim helped me in, well, becoming more self-confident, more confident about working on this topic. What I learned from him is that it's okay. It's okay to work on such topics. It's okay to do it from a perspective that is slightly more political than what philosophers are usually doing, and that it's okay to insist on the philosophical and not only political importance of the topic of dissent, contestation, and disobedience. So that is what I started learning that evening, and I'm very grateful to Jim for having continued that conversation in the following years. So more recently, our discussions have turned around the question of how to understand non-institutionalized practices of contestation, which Jim has so convincingly characterized as practices of civic freedom, with which citizens challenge existing forms of domination, exclusion, and assimilation by contrasting, and now I quote, the low-intensity representative democratic institutions and modern constitutional formations with participatory or high-intensity democratic forms of democratic self-determination and political assertion, end of quote. And what I want to do today is to just talk about three, to my mind, essential features of civil disobedience understood as such a practice of civic contestation. And another thing that one can learn from Jim's work, obviously, is that it's always good to proceed by looking at an example. Or maybe example isn't even the right word, because it's not about illustrating a theoretical point with a phenomenon that you sort of randomly pick from political reality, but rather to see what we can learn from political reality, from practice. So in a more dialogical way, to proceed in a way in which theory gets informed by practice, and you can also learn to see new things in practice that way. Now that's especially relevant, I think, in the case of civil disobedience, because the discussion of civil disobedience in philosophy is marked by a number of systematic shortcomings that I think stem from philosophers' pretty systematic ignorance of the complex reality of disobedience. That has led them to simplified, depoliticized, and frankly, often also quite lame understandings of this practice. And unfortunately, I think that's also true for Rawls and Habermas, up to a certain extent at least. So my discussion today will be in dialogue with one more recent example of political contestation, namely the uprisings in Turkey, the protests that Charles Taylor has also mentioned in his talk yesterday evening. And I want to use this uprising in order to illustrate the more complex and also more political nature of practices of civil disobedience that go beyond what the liberal standard understanding suggests. I will, in the remaining time, focus on three aspects. I will first ask what the civil in civil disobedience actually means, and argue that we should be careful not too quickly, at least, identify civility and also actually the civic character of the practice of contestation with nonviolence. So this is actually a point where I think there are some differences maybe between how I see it and how Jim tends to theorize the idea and practice of nonviolent and civic forms of contestation. Secondly, and then again, I think in agreement with Jim, we have to see what these practices can teach us about political mobilization. And I want to argue that we should really take seriously the essentially collective character of practices of civil disobedience. And thirdly, I want to emphasize something that Charles Taylor has also spoken about yesterday evening, namely the inventiveness or the expansion of the repertoire of collective action that we can see happening in that practice. So first, civility. Now, I would like to start by emphasizing the civil and also the civic character of the protests in Turkey, which is all the more remarkable since it is the outcome of an incredible restraint in the face of massive aggression and repression exercised by the government and the security forces. Civility is an achievement. It's not primarily an expression of loyalty to the state or the existing order, as it has been, I think, misunderstood by large parts of the liberal mainstream, as Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. already knew, and as Jim has consistently emphasized in his work, it is always linked to an individual and collective work on the self. So it's difficult. You really have to work on it. Now, this is especially noteworthy given the evident asymmetry between the practices of contestation citizens engage in and the ways in which states react to it and try to contain it. An asymmetry, I think, which is evident in the pictures you see here and which many of you have already probably seen in the past months. Now, civil is often taken to be identical with nonviolent. And Jim also insists in his work that the same goes for civic, that we should understand the civic character of political contestation as also consisting in its nonviolence. But whether that claim is convincing, of course, depends on how precisely violence is understood. And here, I think, the problem is that, as we all know, this is an extremely contested and politicized notion. Now, my point is not that we should sort of develop a theoretical definition of violence that we can then sort of apply to political reality in order to assess whether certain movements or practices are violent or not violent. I agree with Jim that that's not the right way to proceed. But I would like to argue that without problematizing how both violence and nonviolence are understood in both theory and practice, and also without paying more attention to how this distinction between violence and nonviolence is often politically instrumentalized, without doing that, insisting on the necessarily nonviolent character of civil and civic forms of contestation can be both politically and theoretically problematic. So we sometimes have to remind ourselves that in many countries, including Germany and Turkey, it is officially regarded as an act of violent coercion to sit down on the street or to stand in one place, to do that collectively, or to make fun of the ruling authorities. We have to remind ourselves that often trespassing or damaging private and public property are seen as acts of violence, and often they are assimilated to inflicting harm to persons. That often happens in the media coverage of certain events. So if you, for example, look at how the so-called riots in the banlieue in Paris, or also the London riots, were portrayed even before persons got harmed in them, it was clear that the destruction of private public property was often taken to be as bad as harming people physically. And we should also remind ourselves that it is a feature of what Marcuse once called repressive tolerance that governments pursue a kind of tactic of divide and conquer with regard to protest, portraying some protests as good, good in terms of who engages in them, how they engage in them, and with what aims, and criminalizing other forms of protest, often those, of course, by marginalized groups, by those who are not supposed to protest or to act politically in the first place, and then portraying this as violent. Now, in my view, the civil and civic character of collective action is compatible with the forms of practice I've just mentioned. And more generally, sometimes acts that are classified as falling under the category of violence are actually at the heart of even the tradition of civic and civil engagement. So think of violence against oneself. It plays a very important role in the repertoire of political action and protest movements. I mean, the self-immolation of Bouazizi started the Arab Spring. It's a very violent act. Violence in self-defense regarding, as you see here, for example, defense of collectively organized spaces against police invasion. Or maybe even more obviously what I already mentioned, the destruction of private or public property, which is also often considered to be an act of violence. What is decisive for the civility of protest and for its civic character, in my view, is that it doesn't follow a military logic, that it doesn't aim at the physical destruction of the opponent, that it doesn't aim at inflicting physical harm on the opponent. But I don't think that a variety of acts that are usually categorized as violent necessarily exclude the qualification as civil or civic. So what I claim is that in order to achieve a certain kind of effectiveness, visibility, and also in order to actually be symbolically efficient, civil disobedience often has to go beyond the symbolic. It has to engage in forms of confrontation that can be quite direct, and that will be, by some at least, categorized as violence. Now, we can do two things, of course. We could either challenge that this is the correct description and say, well, what you call violent is actually not violent, and sort of reclaim the label of nonviolence. Or we can argue that, to a certain extent, at least, civility and the civic character are not to be identified with protest being nonviolent. But I think it's important to see that this is constitutive also of the symbolic dimension. Yeah? So often what happens, for example, in Habermas's discussion of civil disobedience is that civil disobedience is reduced to the symbolic dimension. It's considered to be primarily or exclusively as a symbolic act. And I think Jim is completely right in insisting that that is not enough, because it does involve forms of direct action that are not merely symbolic. They are always also symbolic. That's something that the radical left often forgets when it thinks that it can challenge the state and defeat it directly on the street, so to speak. It's another form of fetishization. But it can never be merely symbolic, I think. Now, one last point about civility. As with Occupy in the Turkish protest movement, civility was also connected what is often called prefiguration. And that's another aspect of these protest movements that has always been emphasized in Jim's work. So prefigurative politics anticipates the transformation it seeks to initiate in the way that the struggle is organized, in a horizontal, participatory, inclusive, and civil way, thus breaking with the authoritarian and vanguardist tradition of the radical left. So there is, in these movements, even if they, to a certain extent, can maybe be described in engaging in violent behavior, an internal relation between the means and the ends, which imposes a self-limitation on them, regardless of whether you think that they completely correspond to the ideal of nonviolence or not. So what I wanted to point out in this first section is that the line between violence and nonviolence is a very complicated and politically troubled one. Now, secondly, I want to quickly speak about collective action. What can we learn from protests such as the one in Turkey about political mobilization and collective action? Now, I don't mean this in the sense of looking for a single set of objective causes that can explain why people start to rise up. Very quickly after the events, social scientists, of course, start pointing out that they were absolutely not surprised by what was happening. They say, well, patterns of urban transformation, issues of social mobility, clashing political cultures, generational conflicts, etc., that they had to lead to this event at some point. Now, that's very surprising because none of them mentioned that before it happened, right? I mean, they always come out with this assessment after the fact. And I think this indicates something interesting, namely that there is something irreducible going on here, something that we can neither predict nor explain completely in retrospect. And that the same is true of the people engaged in these protest movements. I mean, none of them would have predicted, in the case of Turkey, for example, that it would have been possible to occupy the park, that it would have been possible to take control over Taksim Square for such a long time. So I think that something else has to happen, in addition to all the social and economic enabling factors that do, of course, play a role and that we shouldn't neglect. Now, in order to see what this something else might be, we have to move beyond both the kind of objectivist focus of social science and the individualist focus of much of liberal political theory, and also the focus of the media on individual heroes of rebellion. I mean, they're also important. You have all probably seen the lady in red, who was, an important sort of catalyzing factor in the early stages of the protest. You might have heard about people like Talsit Man, who was walking around in the streets of Istanbul and offered a chemical solution for those people who had been affected by tear gas, and many other of these figures who were very prominently in the media. As important as their role might have been, we have to look at the essentially collective character of civil disobedience and of these protest movements. The dynamics of collective action is, of course, very difficult to theorize. I mean, that's no news for you. And I think it's obvious that in order to theorize it, we have to take into account the first person perspective of protesters. I mean, theory offers metaphors with which to describe what is going on here. I mean, Hannah Arendt speaks about the joy of acting together and of beginning something new. Actually, Sartre's description of the storming of the Bastille in the Critique de la raison dialectique is one of the best descriptions of the dynamics of collective action that we find in the literature. It's it's a bit crazy, as with almost everything that Sartre writes in this book, but its phenomenological adequacy is surprising. And I think without taking this kind of phenomenology of protest into account, without looking at the dynamics of collective action that unfold in these situations, it will be very difficult for us or for future social theorists to understand what is going on in these situations. So it's not a bunch of isolated individuals that are engaging in protest here. It's a really collective movement in which political agency is asserted in a way in which the sort of horizontal and informal dimension of constitutive power is mobilized against more hierarchical and vertical forms of institutionalized power. So I think these are good examples of what Jim has called high-intensity democracy, and these are necessary for keeping the democratic project alive and moving on. Now, finally, a last and also quick look at what Charles Taylor was talking about yesterday in terms of the repertoire of political action. Obviously, Tahrir, Zuccotti, Syntagma, Taksim are very different spaces and places, very different contexts in which actors with very different aims, strategies, identities, etc., are active. But still, there is something common to all these movements, one could argue. And of course, this has been pointed out already quite often. So what happens in all of them is that public spaces are occupied, and that this occupation is sustained, that through this occupation people reclaim or reappropriate a public space that they think has been disappropriated by the state or by private corporate actors. And again, this occupation is prefigurative in the sense that protesters then organize these spaces in ways that anticipate the kind of social or political organization that they would strive for on the more general level. And I want to just point out three characteristics. Yeah. three characteristics of these movements and these reappropriation of public space. And here you see what happens when the state again takes control of public space. It's not a public space anymore. I mean, if you have to, if the victory of the state looks like that, it's not, I mean, it's obviously not a victory. So I think Nilüfer Gül is right. This can't be the last word. The fact that the protest ended like this is not a success for the government. What happened after this reoccupation of the public space by the state is just that people moved to other spaces. So there were all these assemblies that took place over the following months. And they, as well as the initial occupations, I think, were characterized by three features, and I'll just end by naming them. So the first one is plurality. Plurality in terms of the ideological commitments, the identities, the aims, and also the tactics employed. Yeah, so that this was a real exemplification of what is sometimes called the diversity of tactics. Second, autonomy. There was an emphasis on creating one's own space, creating it in ways that is independent from how the state thinks politics should be organized. Here's a map of all the assemblies that at some point took place in Istanbul. So you had a nice example of local forms of democracy, direct democracy. And the third aspect is, of course, creativity, so the expansion of the repertoire of contestatory collective action. And this happened with astonishing frequency, from the initial occupation, the barricades, etc., to the so-called standing man protest, which the police didn't really know how to handle. And you know, people just started protesting by standing in the street and reading, which was then also regarded as something that you're not allowed to do. And the this creativity is not something that we should regard as too, you know, it's not just entertaining. It's something that protest necessarily has to develop in order to address a variety of problems. The problem of state control and criminalization and how the state tries to stop activists from engaging in what they are doing, the problem of co-optation and integration into the realm of normalized culture and politics, which happens quite quickly, and the problem of what in social movement studies is called the exhaustion of the repertoire of collective action. So as a protest movement, you have to avoid this feeling in the general public that they've seen this before and this is just nothing new. But that's a very difficult thing to do today. And I think what these recent protest movements have taught us is that this is still possible. That's a nice lesson, I think, from practice. Now, I want to end by saying that in order to understand what is going on here, we have to think all these aspects together. We have to emphasize the civil and civic character in the broad sense, the collective nature of these forms of protest, the ways in which they link the symbolic and the contestatory and confrontational, as well as the way in which they are both exemplifying and transforming the public character of political action. I think it is this combination which Jim's work helps us to understand, and I think that in this, his is a truly public philosophy, and I'll end with that. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much.